Hello, horror fans. Welcome to Selling the Scream, a show about horror movies brought to you by one horror nerd and one horror noob. I am Jed Donaldson, the aforementioned noob, leaving us with our nerd, Josh, the titular It Yoakum, a name that will become more relevant as we get into what the movie is this week. How you doing, Josh?
That's right. Pennywise the Clown. I live in the sewer.
Zach.
I'm doing well. How are you?
You know, I'm here. It's a day.
Ends in a Y.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're not alone. We are joined once again by the incomparable Jen Fett. How are you doing, Jen?
Hello. I'm doing well, thanks.
Yeah, she's here so often. She's quickly becoming the third man in our two man game.
I think her and Jason are maybe not tied up yet. You might have one more to do before you tie up with our good pal Jason Duff. But
Nick and Nick.
Maybe we could both be on once at the same time.
Ooh.
Or would that be like crossing the streams or something?
I don't think podcasts could handle it.
No matter who wins, we lose.
Plus, we have to find a non-horror movie that you guys could both watch.
Yeah, Jason exclusively watches thrillers. But yeah, how are y'all's... holidays. I know we were kind of catching up a little bit before this, but you know, if it's not being recorded and broadcast, then did we even really have the conversation?
Sometimes I'm not sure. my holiday was fine. We went out to my grandparents' house, but not the one you think. No, we normally go to my mom's side of the family, and this year we went to my dad's side. My grandfather on that side passed away this past year, so I thought it was kind of important to spend a little more time with them, just to keep things even. I'm sure one will die on the other side soon enough, and we'll have to go back over there, so, you know.
Okay, starting us off on a high note.
it was meant to be funny, not sad, but I guess I'll take the groans.
Yeah, that's one of the attempted stand up. That's how it's gone as well. Just sorry to bum you guys out. Like, how about you, Jen? You're jumping in there as well.
Yeah. My Thanksgiving was just very, very low key. But if we're talking about all recent holidays, I did go to New Orleans for Halloween, which was amazing.
I really want to talk about dead grandparents.
Well, I did not see any of those in New Orleans.
All right, well, New Orleans is fine. It's a close second.
But coincidentally, some of the pictures that I took from that trip that I posted, people commented and on how they were like, "Were you on the set of It Follows 2? Where the hell are you?" We took a bunch of pictures in front of these like old abandoned buildings across from this goth club that we were at. I'll have to post it on the Facebook group because it truly does look like it came straight out of this movie. So
I think I did see some of those pictures from Halloween. You dressed as the Lydia Deetz as a bride from Beetlejuice.
Yeah. It was a great. Thank you. Highly recommend everyone visit New Orleans
like
for Halloween. Well, maybe not.
I don't think I've talked about it on the show before, but I've been celebrating these past couple years just from a combination of like moving out here during the pandemic and not really having like folks around to celebrate with, and also like just, you know, it's easier to explain the historical context without feeling like an asshole. I've been celebrating on that day Food Crime Thursday, which is a sort of Iron Chef version of the holiday where you pick an ingredient and then you there are no limitations around what you do with that. And if you feel like having a very indulgent meal for three meals, if you want to have like dessert for dinner, that's all within bounds.
Throw it on the ground and eat it like the animal you are.
But yeah, the first year I did it, I did pork, and I did peanut butter. And this year, a little more of a cheat option, I did garlic, and I can just kind of go in everything, but had a good one. Made a kind of a fancy pants dinner, and we spent $150 on one bag of groceries, which is like a new one for me.
Not at New Seasons or at New Seasons, because it makes a difference.
at market of choice, and apparently the choice was to empty my bank account.
Was it worth it?
It was pretty good. I'd say, like, you know, worth like $75 to $80 of that $142.
So about half of what you paid.
But yeah, I also, you know, over the weekend, actually today, we went to like a little German town that was having like a hazelnut festival just to, you know, get out and do something. And driving back, I saw something that like I felt like needed to be addressed on this show. It's just something I've never seen anywhere else. It was like a fruit stand, but instead of fruit, they were selling machetes.
What?
A machete stand?
Which, like, you know, with our dedication to Jason Voorhees and wondering where he finds all the things he finds.
Like, I mean, with, I'm not sure how to make that racist.
Are you gonna, try there?
I was gonna.
Okay. I just want to know, wait, did you get one? And where was this?
If you didn't, that's a missed opportunity. You got to live life, bro.
We were in a bit of a rush, but I've pinned it on my map.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, we're going to go back. It's not going to be
there, and it's never going to have been there.
Reminds me of like another favorite story of mine is setting up a little garage sale in like a big neighborhood wide garage sale event and having somebody show up with like dead serious. And we have like four tables of stuff out, like just books, exercise equipment, whatever, just random stuff we're selling. And he walks up to both me and my partner at the time is just like, do you have any jewelry or knives? And we kind of look at each other and we're like, no. And he's just like, well, put out some jewelry or knives when you want to make some real money.
Thanks for the tip.
That's great to know because I'm planning to have a garage sale when the spring rolls around and I have a lot of jewelry, but now I will throw some knives in there. I didn't know I had to do that.
Maybe hit the 2-for-1 and fashion some into knives.
Ooh, the malignant. Cool. Well, do we talk about garage sales here?
Sometimes. Unfortunately, no. We do talk about horror movies, though, and I guess we're going to continue that trend today. Specifically, ones that Josh has chosen in an attempt to turn me into a fan of the genre. He's doing all right. Today, we're doing... I guess it's a horror movie. I guess it does have some scary stuff in it.
Maybe. Oh, we're doing that? Okay.
Maybe. All
right, yeah. Noted.
It's hard.
No, it follows.
No, it does follow. We are doing It Follows.
Yeah, we're doing the 2014, really kind of wide release 2015 indie breakout horror hit, It Follows. Maybe kind of like right around the birth of this, of the elevated horror conversation. This was like I think it was the best reviewed horror movie on Rotten Tomatoes, like in probably a decade, like when it came out. Yeah. So we're going to be diving into this one. It's got like metaphors and shit. Yeah. So David Robert Mitchell, who made this, this is his second feature. I have not seen his first one. I don't know if either of you have seen The Myth of the American Sleepover.
No.
Doesn't even sound like a thing.
You just made that up. But he makes this one after and goes to shop it around and nobody's really interested. Horror is not a thing. It's if it's not a paranormal activity, I guess it's just because I think this is right around like when the Saw movies started flailing too, when like they finally released like the 10th one on the subsequent Halloween and it didn't do well and they're like, ah, we're dead.
Saw can't make it.
Yeah. If this green torture movie with an increasingly convoluted plot that makes the MCU look like, a children's book. Mm-hmm. Can't make it. What can? But Yeah, he wrote this one based on a recurring anxiety dream he'd had since childhood about just
his teeth falling out.
Yeah, somebody following him. The sex part kind of didn't come until later. He hit puberty and all of a sudden like, oh wait, let me work this in.
Oh yeah, that's what was missing. Boners. Well,
and Josh, it's worth mentioning too that I think he said he started having those dreams like right around the time his parents said they were getting divorced.
Yeah, yeah, it's some real shit gets introduced into somebody's life and you start to process that how you can, and this started to develop into an idea for a horror script that he was working on. He cited a lot of, he likes horror. He doesn't exclusively work in the genre, but was specifically citing Carpenter, Cronenberg, and Romero as influences. Mm-hmm. I know there was like another. Yeah, if you're gonna go with some, right? Go with those. I know there's a photographer that like he and the cinematographer were talking about like really kind of going for the look for it, but in a stunning display of poor research, I did not write that down.
That would be Gregory Crudson.
Okay.
And I did look up his work. I was unfamiliar, but I can, if you just Google him and look at the first image results that come up, you can totally see the connection. It's impressive.
It would be great if you just like linked to it though, and it was like a guy who takes like senior pictures for high school, just like laser backgrounds, people leaning,
or like clowns everywhere.
But yeah, the sexual element of this, because there's like this, you know, we'll get into what the movie is, but gets kind of added on later on. It's kind of, it was a little unclear from the interviews I was seeing if that became part of the dream or if that was just sort of like, oh, I need to put this on in the script to make it slightly less dreamlike, because this is a very ethereal movie that kind of is set in a certain place in America. It's set in Detroit, but we'll get into it. Like it's the winds of this, or even like what time of year it is, like don't really add up. Don't really. There's a lot of things pointing in different directions. I think that's pretty intentional too. Also curious if either of you have seen his follow-up to this, which is a movie that's like catnip for me, the Under the Silver Lake.
I have not.
It's been in my queue for a very long time, and for whatever reason, I keep just passing it over. But
there's a really good chance you won't like it. Most people did not.
That's, yeah, I've heard that. So that's probably why it keeps like slipping further down.
But that's like, we'll get into kind of the literary ties in this movie, but that's sort of almost his like crying of Lot 49, sun-drenched, surreal neo-noir movie with Andrew Garfield. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. It does do a thing that I love that, you know, I can certainly understand if other folks don't, and just send a rope up its own butthole and climb up all the way.
Wow.
it's a bit like that, but I this one is my favorite of his, even if that one is like tailor-made specifically for me.
Well, now I have to watch it.
Just to see what kind of asshole you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Do you want to get into the literary stuff up top, or do we just want to hit that when we get there in the movie?
I think maybe we should hit that when we get there, because we haven't actually talked about the movie at all yet.
Yeah, so It Follows. It's the sex ghost. It's the the monster that chases you after you do it, right? That's the gimmick. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Obviously.
I think this had a pretty good marketing campaign leading up to it, even if it did like kind of spoil the big jump scare in the middle of it. But I think this movie has like a lot going on. It's playing a lot with like mood and tone, and we start off pretty strong. We get this like this very Carpenter-esque like subjective camera just tracking through and following Annie, our first character that we're introduced to, who is on the run, will not take off her heels.
She made that decision.
Wait, I do need to say something about Annie's outfit, which I think does a perfect job of setting up this like timeless environment, because, and also sort of a lot of the thematic elements, because it's, she's wearing silk pajama shorts, a tank top, and pumps. And she has a necklace on too, I believe. So it's just, she looks like a child playing dress up.
Yeah, she does. She looks like she's pretending to be fancy.
Right. So I think it, anyway, I just wanted to say that because I thought that outfit was like a very intentional kind of like,
yeah, the
introduction into the world that we're about to enter, right?
And I think wardrobe plays like a huge function in this movie too. There's a lot of there's a jacket that our main character Jay is wearing later on, this like crazy patterned like fur lined coat that she's wearing around, and like there's a lot going on with that stuff. We'll get there as we go. But I think some key things get established up top that she's definitely frightened. She's definitely on the run for something, but like, she's also not acknowledging it. People are asking her if she needs help. She's running past her father. She is just pedal to the metal, but she's not asking for any assistance with what's
like,
going
on. Looking back at this, having watched the whole thing now, I'm curious, like, obviously she's running because she's scared. And I assume she's scared because she saw it. But I don't know where she saw it, because she kind of leaves the house and then goes down the street and then comes back to the house and then gets in the car and drives. So I'm not sure exactly where the threat was coming for her.
I mean, it's partially positioned almost like the camera. It's like it's what. And I think that's also really intentional because we don't know what we're dealing with yet.
Yeah. And also, I don't think it matters at this point.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff here that, like, if you're looking for grounding, this movie has like a lot of dream logic stuff to it that I don't want to say like nothing matters and nothing ties together. It's not quite like, you know, Eraserhead or something where it's like nothing makes sense. It's just some like thematic nightmare. But it's also a little floaty with the details sometimes. And she flees to a beach. We have this recurring motif of the water in this movie, and gives a very desperate phone call, leaving a message for her dad, as staying awake in her the lights of the on her car, and then hard cut to morning. And so Jed, this isn't a horror movie,
right?
All right. Now, this is freaky, but I'm not sure that, aside from the stuff that's like very intentionally meant to disturb you, I'm not sure that that's entirely what the movie is.
I would 100% disagree with you, but I will say my piece at the end. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she has been bent in a very unnatural direction. She's on the beach with her leg like up and coming back towards her, like bent at the knee the opposite way, like that one of those heels just kind of dangling there.
It is jarring. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a sudden transition that it's almost like that Hereditary where you don't think you're gonna see the thing and then you see the thing in a smash cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's to set up the stakes. That's that gets us ready to meet our true protagonist for this movie. We meet Jay in her pool, being leered at by some neighborhood boys. And
can we mention the tiniest above ground pool I've ever seen for an adult human being?
it's kind of smaller.
Was it a hot tub?
It was a bucket.
But I think there's another like just sort of thematically important thing that happens here, where it's the she's got like an ant crawling on her arm in the middle of the pool, and she just like slowly submerges her arm in the pool to get the ant off.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of existential horror in this movie. I think that's a good frame for maybe like where Jay and the other people kind of fit in the universe once they're in the under the gaze of the titular it, as you would say.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the stuff that is going on here with like the time frame being like off, like a lot of the cars are older model cars that are like in good condition. We've got a lot of CRT TVs, including my favorite, the TV stacked on top of the other TV.
Oh, the TV on the TV, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there.
Everyone's watching like 50s era sci-fi, including Killers from Space, starring enemy of the show Peter Graves.
I was going to ask if you knew what everything was, because yeah, that they were watching. I should have known better.
With the bug-eyed aliens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a speaking of like monsters that maybe didn't work too well, that's the Killers from Space monsters, the just give them some big eyes, it's terrifying.
Works for me.
But we meet Jay comes in, and like her friend group is all there. So her sister has already come out and like interacted. We find out that she's going on a date that night. Her sister Kelly, and their childhood friend Paul, who's the guy from Atypical, Keir Gilchrist.
Yeah, and also from United States of Terra.
Yeah, yeah. And then their friend Yara, and while we've got those CRT TVs, Yara has the Clampact as this e-reader that she's reading on.
It's a
the C-reader.
Which is one of my favorite characters in the entire movie. I love that thing. I've been obsessed with it since I saw this. Yeah, I love that. Oh.
And we kind of get the aspirations of this movie, the highfalutin aspirations of this movie up top, when they could quote anybody. They quote Dostoevsky. that's our first literary drop here. I have not read a ton. I've read his shortest work so that I can say that I've read something by Dostoevsky. I read Notes from Underground, but she's reading The Idiot, which was his most personal work. Yeah, she had an idea and it got away from her. Isn't that like the state bit where they have to like do the highbrow and lowbrow humor, like in the split screen? Like he's bringing Dostoevsky into it, so he has to have the character doing that, like just rip ass.
I haven't seen that one.
The Idiot is tackles kind of a kind of guileless character who like terror in the world surrounds him, and he's like knows about it and accepts it, but is not like corrupted by it. That's kind of the thrust of the novel from what light research has told me about one of the great works of Russian literature, famously not dense and subject to hundreds of years of critical analysis.
I haven't read it either.
But we get two readings from that. We get the she reads briefly the section a little bit later on, kind of when the monster's first introduced, about if someone's like in a collapsing house, that they should just like let it collapse around them. That bit, and then later on at the end of the movie, Which, by the way, like, Yara's made it 20 pages into the book, which, like, you know, fair enough. There's, she's got shit going on. But,
I mean, I think that that passage pertains pretty well to the opening scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
She goes out to the beach to accept her fate.
Just meet it in the water. I mean, I don't know, like, I'm not saying you should, like, load up the pockets with stone and just wolf it, but, like,
oh, God.
Maybe, as opposed to what ended up happening. Cause this
Which
is
strange, because every other time we see it kill something, it's not that gory or grisly.
I mean...
I'd stick to differ.
It's troubling.
On one of them. We'll get there. Yeah.
But and the other, I mean, Greg is the other person who we see killed by this thing, right?
Yeah.
He's not torn to pieces with body parts mangled in different directions and ripped off.
No,
I'm
but
not
it
saying
is
it's nice works. What happens.
What happens seems to be pretty great, actually.
No, I'm saying you can't tell me that you're going to compare the two and say this was not objectively less gruesome than the first one.
I don't know. I also feel like, you know, we see flashes of that one. I'm kind of wondering, like, if that was the end of it. But if you know, we don't see a lot of his legs. They don't focus on his legs that much. Chapter.
No. He gets humped to death by someone that looks like his mom, which is revolting, but he's not missing body parts.
But again, which is worse?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I feel like we're jumping ahead.
I guess psychological trauma doesn't really play on the screen that well.
We don't know what it looked like when it came for Annie.
No, but that's we know true. What happened afterwards.
One other thing I do kind of want to like establish up top, we'll get to the other quote from the idiot when we get to that scene at the end, but is that adults are also like really not very present in this movie. It's just people kind of in this like end of high school young adult age range that kind of figure in at all, and our characters with agency and lines and parts, like the parents have like a little bit of lines, but it's like they're usually like out of frame or obscured, or you know, actually now the it naked coming at them. But yeah, I find that like a really interesting choice too, like the mom's usually blurred or cut out of Kelly and Jay, and like, or we're seeing her like in a reflection with an empty wine bottle and a burning cigarette.
Yeah, we really only see her like she's having a conversation with maybe a friend, like we see like in passing, and then we see her like passed out on the bed, and then she's in the hospital room with her at the end, like towards the end.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's not unique to horror movies that like the teenage victims or you know, protagonists don't have authority figures in their life that can offer any sort of like salvation or escape. It's like, well, let's call the police, like, okay, and tell them
what exactly.
Mm-hmm. but it's time for Jay to start to encounter this, and that's with Hugh, her new boyfriend. And they go to a movie theater and go to see Charade with an organist. Huh.
Which, oh, I want to.
But wasn't like Charade like a talkie? Isn't that like a...
No.
What do you mean talkie?
Cary Grant?
Yeah, like I don't think that's like a silent film where they're like...
No, you know how they... No. No, but they do the intermissions and the preludes and, you know, things like that in those classic theaters. It looked like a charming, charming date, and I don't think Hugh would have actually been smart enough to choose that for them. So
you think that's a J date?
Sure.
I think it is just another example of how out of time this movie is. Like, I don't know that I've ever been in a theater or even heard of a theater that still had this sort of stuff set up.
Oh, the Hollywood down the street for me does, and the one I used to go to in Chicago did too. Anyway, sorry. I digress.
But they do a thing here before they go see the movie where they play a childhood game of Jay's, the trade game, where they basically look around, they pick somebody that they want to trade spots with, and the other person has two guesses to guess who they picked. Jay fails to guess correctly with Hugh, and Hugh has chosen a small child with his whole life ahead of him who can shit wherever he wants, which, like, you know, just get into podcasting, baby. That's but this sets up that Hugh has seen it, because he's guessing for Jay and saying, oh, the girl in the yellow dress, and she can't see it. So do you want to get into the rules for the monster now, or do you want to get into the rules for the monster when Hugh explains them to Jay?
I think when good he, time, isn't he?
No, I think it when he explains it.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You convinced me.
No, just because it's all part of the of her experience of learning it. I think, yeah, it's important that how he tells her, and anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. The only thing that really happens kind of between the dates is there's more establishing stuff with her friends, and we also meet, like, her neighbor Greg, who's like, I kind of always, like, get excited, like, oh, Friday Night Lights, Taylor Kitsch, John Carter of Mars, Taylor Kitsch is on this movie. but it is not. He's shredded, but he doesn't quite have those cum gutters that a Taylor Kitsch would bring to the proceedings.
Daniel Zavato.
Yeah.
Should hire him for.
And he's kind of the broodier cool guy who lives across the street working on his muscle cars. I think that, like, a lot of this stuff is just important for setting the tone of the movie, though, because I think this is it's a very stagey movie. There's, like, that lamp prop that she's got in her room, those flower lamp that's, like, just feels, you know, that another out of place, out of time,
mm-hmm.
weird thing. And we're kind of seeing this a lot, like, later on during, like, this sex scene where things are just kind of, like, lit, like, in isolation and lit, like, just very stark images
mm-hmm.
propped up. So just, even though nothing, like, really crazy is happening now, I think it's establishing the visual language of the movie in a lot of ways. There's also a lot of, like, controlled use of focus too. Like, it's he's very mindful of, like, what he is showing you and when. Just even things like when they're having a meal after the date where he has to flee the theater because he sees that girl in red and he's got to leave right now. He keeps them foregrounded in focus, and there's somebody, like, out of focus walking across the street towards him before, like, he pulls both into focus. So it's, like, this kind of depth of field manipulation to get you acclimated to looking for movement in the background, for looking for mm-hmm. someone that's not supposed yeah. to be there. I think it's pretty cool how he does it. There's a lot of, like, crowd shots where, you know, most people are moving, like, crossways across the crowd, and somebody's coming towards camera, and you're just like, oh, hold on, what?
Mm-hmm.
So they have another date. Things are going well, despite Hugh's weird behavior. They have sex in his car, again, like, very stagey and brightly lit for in a abandoned parking lot next to an abandoned parking garage in, like, the middle of nowhere in Detroit.
That can be very romantic. It all just depends on the
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fellas, take notes.
Not going to second guess you here.
Actually, the back behind the dumpster of the Denny's is a really fancy location. But again, there's like, I think it's really important in this movie, kind of what the characters are saying too. Like they Jay talks about after their post-coital talk, about kind of this idea of in childhood wanting the freedom that you think you're going to have as an adult and then getting it and then realizing you don't know what to do with it. That
and
like,
as she's saying it too, she's like just absentmindedly like kind of playing with I guess they're weeds, right? Yeah. They're like little like white flowers, but it's just such a like childlike thing to be doing while she's saying it. It's so innocent, you know.
There's a lot of that in this movie, and yeah. I'm kind of like curious. We're like something will be going on like really important, and she'll be focused on her hands and what she's doing, like putting blades of grass on her knee, or
right
in the hospital, kind of like manipulating the stuff that's on her tray in front of her, sort of tuning out the rest of the world and looking directly at her own, you know, your hands are your agency, staring directly at it. But it's, I think this idea more than kind of the STD idea is where I kind of see a lot of the metaphorical thrust of this movie at.
Yep.
This idea of just sort of being paralyzed by indecision and lack of meaning and like defining yourself as an adult and what that means, like kind of the hard reality of it. But before we get too philosophical, there's some chloroform that gets introduced to this.
Yeah, he totally pulls the, does this smell like chloroform, right? After she's just said this, like, you know, very childlike, innocent thing.
It's vulnerable. It's a, you know, it's, she's opening up to him about, like,
right,
herself as well, and thinking they've shared this moment, and that not that he has an ulterior motive. So I guess I feel like, Jed, you kind of knew a bit what this movie was, but I feel like if you kind of go into this movie cold, this next scene can feel like, what the hell movie did I like sign up for?
I mean, it's not as out of the blue when you take into consideration the opening scene, but yeah, based on what you've seen since then, it is kind of a left turn.
Yeah, because we don't know it hasn't been explained in the movie yet what kind of the method of attack of this force is or what it's doing.
Right.
We just know somebody was running from something. But she wakes up in the parking structure, tied to a wheelchair, and he starts very quickly explaining what has happened to her.
Wow.
With no clothes on, may I mention. He can't even put her dress back on before he ropes her up to the wheelchair.
No, he's kind of a piece of shit.
Oh, totally.
He's running laps and, you know, just constantly vigilant around the outside edge of the parking structure.
Yeah. So let's talk about a little bit about this monster, because he explains what it is here. So it does kind of follow as like it works as an STD where it's passed from one person to another, but it's like a chain that goes that goes up. So it's this invisible creature that, unless you're, you know, unless you've watched the cursed videotape or, you know, whatever else that
right, the
moves
sex
you from
really,
the real world.
The sex could be anything. That's just the transmission method.
Yeah. Once you've done that, it is going to walk at you constantly in a straight line. It is, however, as he explains, not stupid. It will,
it's just
like
very slow.
It's very. It will. It will improvise. It will. You know, walk to the side if there's a door there.
That would make this thing so much less threatening if it couldn't operate doors.
If it was like a what are they called? The little vacuum cleaners, like hitting a corner and not being able to turn.
Just constantly.
Oh, Roomba. He does say there's only one of it. There will only be one of it. And sometimes I think it looks like people you love just to hurt you.
Because it can change its appearance. It can look like anybody.
And it does often.
Yeah, oftentimes you're naked parents. That seems to be the thing that shows up most often.
It's fond of nudity.
Because I don't know if you realized it, but this is Hugh's mom that shows up in its first form here.
Oh, no, I had no idea. How would you know that?
Because they look. I watched it three times, and they're the same person. And when you see her again answering the door, the camera like lingers on her and is just like, "Hey."
Oh, interesting.
But she starts coming towards the structure and comes up inside, and he was like quickly explaining these rules and like just keeping her out of the monster's reach. Before he just takes her home, and again, she's doesn't have her clothes on, nope. drops her out of the car and says, "Don't let it touch you."
Right. And she's still zip tied. He doesn't even untie her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is where we get that first idiot quote where her friends are kind of waiting for her. And it's also kind of being very quickly established that that Paul is a bit of a nice guy. He's got a crush on Jay, and even so much so, like, it's annoyingly so when the other two are talking about her and talking, like, lamenting about how pretty she is, and he's just like, "Well, she's nice."
Yeah.
Now we wanted to hear, bro. They're also playing Old Maid, which seems kind of thematically on point here as well.
It's a really childish game to be playing.
It is, but it's also like the point of Old Maid is to like pass the old maid,
right? To get along. Right.
But yeah, it's treated at this point like a sexual assault. She's telling people that she like kind of saw something too, but they find out that he's not. He gave a fake name. He's gone. There's nothing at the scene. Yeah, they just they kind of show the fallout of this. This is also where we get the conversation between the moms. Greg's mom comes across, and they're like kind of having this conversation in the background about like not being able to find the guy. That's how we're finding out this information. She's pouring booze into her coffee as they're like remembering that French waiter Jean-Luc. Yeah, there's also like I think an interesting. I say mirroring, but it's literally a mirror scene where we had the scene where Jay's getting ready for her date and like hopeful and trying to like present her best self. And then there's this mirror scene after the date where she's like in her underwear, like regarding her body with suspicion and like.
Mm-hmm.
And fear, really.
Yeah.
And there's that scene where he dumps her out of the car in her underwear too is like one of the main reasons why I would say that this is a horror movie. Like that, you know, just that's one element of it is just the, you know, violence against women and like the lack of response to it and not to get political on, you know, but
fair and also, you know, shame on me for not trying to see it from that point of view, but it's not always first nature for, I guess, any guy to really look at it from that point of view.
Sure. I just think there's so many different angles that this movie takes in terms of looking at what is terrifying to certain groups of people and to all people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, not to jump too far ahead to the end, but I think like he is exceptionally culpable. And then, at the end of the movie, as this has been like moved further along, we're with characters that we like a bit more. So it's harder to really internalize, engage their further complicity and culpability in this chain going down.
They did the same thing. So, yeah.
But this leads to our next direct, I was going to say literary allusion, but it's like a just direct reading of text in the movie. Jay's in school and they start reading T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which is his like third most famous work behind The Wasteland and Cats, I would say. Like, I know that T.S. Eliot wrote the poems that Cats is based on. Every time I think about it or say it, it strikes me again as like, what a fucking ridiculous statement it is.
I know.
You can't get around it.
I wonder if like T.S. Eliot is spinning in his grave that they haven't released the butthole cut of Cats yet. Like,
gotta be, right?
It's how I envisioned it.
And I love that that's how he sounds in your head.
No, that's just how he sounds. It's not just Josh's head.
Okay, side note. We're talking about poets here. Jed, do you remember in high school...
The goat for the balloon man?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we, our well-meaning teacher really wanted us to resonate with E.E. Cummings' work. So she brought in like a video of him like reading his poem about the goat-footed balloon man. Have you, Jen, have you ever heard E.E. Cummings' voice before?
I don't think so.
You'll never forget it if you have.
It is literally the priest from Princess Bride. It is literally
it's not even a slight exaggeration. That's
precisely it. How is that not the first thing in any write-up about E. Cummings? Like, and when you open your like English senior English book, like E. Cummings, who talked like a cartoon character. Was a great but this poem is like one of my like absolute favorites that I've like that was, I don't know how you feel about it, Jen. I know you've read it, but
oh no, it used to be my, I used to have the whole thing memorized. I love this poem.
Yeah. And this particular section of it, it's So again, it's progressively like someone's life, like very quickly moving from like youth to old age, and like all regrets and things that you could have done, but like, if I do this, then I won't do this. And there's conversations going on in the other room. I'm really being reductive, but the podcast is only so long.
Right. And to me, at its heart too, Prufrock is about just anxiety that never goes away, and like insecurity that you don't age out of, you can't think your way out of. So to me, that was the thread to me that like was so brilliant in including that poem in this scene. And then also, of course, the line, I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker, right?
Yeah.
The eternal footman being death in whatever form, right?
Yeah, or just even craving a life without awareness or choice. The I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas, like wishing to trade your human existence to be a crab in the depths, moving from detritus to detritus, like, and never questioning anything. And this is when she first sees the form of it. And it's an old woman. It's what was that?
The titular it, please.
Yeah, okay, sorry. but it's you know, we have this poem that's like directly referencing like the awareness of your own mortality and the specter of death, and the first form that she sees it coming towards her as is like an old woman like staggering toward her.
And she's just wearing like a hospital gown, kind of, right?
Yeah.
Looks like.
Yeah, just a specter of death coming at her. And she even tests it. She like says hello to it, and we see that the people like behind it react, and it does not. Pretty great stuff. So she freaks out, goes to her friends, and tries to come up with a plan. And their plan is to like just all camp out at her house, and you know, put the fear to rest.
I feel like that's pretty standard plan for teenagers.
Yeah, and that's like they talked about in making this, like, because I think some people get a little upset that the final act of this movie, where they enact their grand plan to kill it, is such a terrible plan. And he's just like, well, like, you're 19, you come up with a plan to kill like a monster candy killed. But yeah, the we also establish a little bit more just how like dopily in love Paul is with Jay, where like he's really trying. Well, of course, gladly, my lady. A tip of the fedora to you.
Yeah.
But you know, they've had some closeness, and she wants folks there. She lets him go sleep on the couch, and this movie he's watching her. I don't remember what this one is, but it's some sort of 50s monster movie they're watching all the time, again, to just sort of like, that's exclusively what they watch on TV. So they have a little conversation about their history, and you find out that he's a sister kisser. He kissed both Jay and Kelly. Mm-hmm. And then they tell this story again. Like, I think a lot of the stuff just like ties back into these grand themes here, where it's a sex thing, where it's they find porn magazines in the woods, which like,
no, not woods. If it was woods, I'd believe it. It was behind, in an alley behind a store.
That's not where Johnny Porno Seed operates. He leaves those in the woods. Do you think there's just like untended boxes of porn in the woods now? Like, is there still somebody leaving them, but kids have the internet, so they're not looking for them? It's such a weird universal experience that people our age have.
Wait, kind of makes me sad to think about.
Yeah, finding them in the woods. You never found woods porn?
No, only guys find woods porn, Josh. Girls are not looking for the pornography in the woods.
Oh my god.
Well, I mean, I wasn't seeking it out. It was thrust upon me.
You tell yourself that.
That was my Joseph Campbell's Hero's Quest.
You're going to say you weren't looking for it, but you definitely found it. So you tell me.
Woods porn. Interesting. Okay.
But they talk about finding these magazines and like not understanding what they were looking at, and like spreading them out, and like the only knowing how bad they were by the reaction of the adults who found them. Mm-hmm. At it. So there's a window smash, and Paul doesn't see anything. He sees the window's broken, and he goes to go fetch the others. Well, Jay just goes in slow motion to check it out for herself. Mm-hmm. I think this is maybe where like the metaphor and the stuff about sexual assault like really hit for me. Not that the scene with Jay earlier was like great and easy, but the form that it has taken in her kitchen. Looks like a very much like a sexual assault or murder victim.
She's missing teeth, like she's half clothed and really dirty, and yeah, it's
pissing herself.
Yep. it's terrifying.
Burying the lead a bit. Leading.
She has no makeup on, first of all.
Certainly beat up.
First of all, a real butterface, also pissing on the floor. So Jay goes like fleeing and panicking, of course, runs upstairs. The others are kind of call, like asking to come in, and then They hear a knock on the door once Kelly and Paul are in there. And they finally convince her to open the door because Yara says it's just her, the friend with the clam reader. They open the door. She gives like a what? And then the biggest goddamn guy in the universe comes out of the hallway. Too big.
He's a large man.
7'7".
Yeah. And too much. Boxers, right?
Yeah.
He had a shirt on.
Did he?
It doesn't look like he has eyes.
Oh.
Very, very hollow eyes. I think also like the makeup applied to give him that misfit skeleton look. Yeah, so she's able to escape out the window, getting chased down, and then like runs out to like the playground, and again like this like living between the world of youth and adulthood, like flees to a swing set, where friends catch up.
It's also though about they're smart. These kids, like when they figure out what's going on right away, they're all smart about it in that they go to places where they have. Their view is not obstructed anywhere, yeah. Right? Like, so she sits on the swing set. She can see all around her. Same thing with, like, I think.
That would have been, like, a tense escape if she kept, like, turning around to see, like, 360, and then she sees the monster, and then the swing starts to spin her.
I don't know. I think it was going to the playground has double meaning, right? Like, yeah, like you said, it is... It hits on the kind of immaturity and adolescence of the whole thing, but also it's smart.
Yeah, and like, I mean, one thing I'm bagging on Paul a little bit here, but like, I think one thing I really do like about this movie is that like, there's not like the shitty asshole friend. There's not the like, why are these people hanging out with each other friends that you sometimes get like, and you know, in your Friday the 13th and your pumpkin's head.
right, you certainly can believe that these people are. Friends
and have like genuine care and affection for each other, even if you know maybe sometimes it's misplaced or weird or desperate. But Greg has seen this go down. He's out just smoking a J with a cameo appearance from the star of our director's first film. Before he goes to check out on them and he doesn't believe them, but he also, like, you know, he's up for an adventure.
Got nothing better to do.
He does know that she was, like, assaulted and is, like, you know, is fearful and believes that somebody broke their window. But they decide to start by doing a little research and figuring out about Hugh. They know his house, even though she's never been inside. So they go to a home that promises a jump scare in every closet and a soiled mattress in every attic.
I want to point out that they did reference this earlier when she was initially, you know, interviewed by the cops and paramedics after she was dropped off. And they said that they went to the house that she said he lived at. It was empty and he had rented it under a false name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, like, man, these kids are good at doing crimes. I guess you get some skills. I feel like there's usually, like, you know, getting an apartment here, I had to, like, submit credit checks. And
I wouldn't know how to do it now. And I have a house. I live in one.
But, yeah, they investigate here, and they do find a clue. This is also, like, another chance to, like, let Greg get a little male-gazy as Yara's looking in the cupboards with her clam, which also doubles as a flashlight. And then upstairs, like in a pile of porn, they find a photo of Hugh, and they recognize it's like he's got the other person in the photo has a Letterman's jacket on it, so they can place the high school he went to, and they know that he went to. School probably in the indeterminate 4 years before this movie's indeterminately set. They get to play detective a little bit more, figure out his real name is Jeff and go back to his address. You know, where they meet up with Jeff, who's very concerned that they've come to his mom's house. Because he's passed it on. You just got to do the same thing. It's easy for you because you're a girl.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
he also plainly states it at one point in this scene. He says, like, flat out, you have to decide if you want to give it to somebody else. Like, it's up to you now.
But also, like, as soon as they get you, they're going to get me. Why are you here?
Right. But also, fuck this guy. Again, he left her in the street. Like, I can't believe she's not more mad when she sees him again.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you, but also I do feel for him a little bit, because how would I react in a situation like this where I know I'm going to die?
You'd be like, well, first things first, I got to go get some Josh Hartnett hair. I got to go. Go get some Halloween H2O, cut my own hair. I think this scene's important just for, like, just establishing also, like, his desperation around it, and that, like, that brings all of her friends on board, except mm-hmm. for Greg, who's just like, still don't buy it, but still here for y'all, still here for this. Road trip.
Yeah,
he's got just the place they can go.
Yeah, they go to a beach house, which, again, like, we've seen a lot of folks wearing, like, winter wear, and they're in Michigan, but they just go to, like, the beach for, like, summertime fun. Mm-hmm. You know, strip down to their swimsuits and hit the town. It's a little, like, montage-y here. We do get Greg introduces his Chekhov's gun. Mm-hmm. They're all terrible shots, which will continue to be a, like, recurring
later on is the best.
Another kind of cool, like, scare here, though, because when it finally shows up, it takes the form of Yara, and it's doing, like, the two camera scene where it's, like, showing Jay on the beach and then clicking over to, like, the behind the shoulder on her, like, her watching her friends out on the beach, and you see mm-hmm. Yara coming down the path. But then also Yara, like, out in the water, paddling by on a flotation device.
Right.
It's so uncanny, yeah, because she's, like, when Yara's approaching from behind, she's walking at a completely normal clip, you know? There's nothing really strange about it. And then she just kind of floats across in an inner tube, like, hey, guys, come in the water.
How long do you think they were at this beach house?
How long? This
is one of those things where, you know, you can say, oh, it's kind of dreamy and you know, mm-hmm. unhinged from time or untethered or whatever. But they drove for a while to get here. And it seems like if it caught up, like, the same day or the next day.
Yeah, it's I mean, the director did say that the it could take a plane to follow you. So maybe it hopped on a bus. It just thumbed its way along.
I mean, I guess if no one else can see it, that makes it a little easier to just travel, huh?
Ooh, I know. It skitches.
Just strapped onto the back of a car. It's wearing Heelys.
But this is a fairly low-budget movie. And I think this is an effect that they just really kind of achieved with, like, you know, a wig and some fishing wire, but it works. Mm-hmm. It's a great effect where we see her as her friends see the entity grab her by the hair. Her hair just lifts up off of her head and she gets yanked out of her chair by her hair. This does establish some other important things about it. The fact that it is going for you, but if you get in the way of it, it will absolutely body you out of the way.
Yes.
She's able to escape. They flee to that shed.
But Paul gets, like, knocked out of the frame.
Oh yeah, he's, like, right? Clawed by this thing and, like, mm-hmm. and CGI'd off the screen.
Mm-hmm.
But the entity appears here. Well, it kicks in the door of, like, the boathouse they're hiding in. And it looks like it's in the tall dude form. And then it switches to the peeping boy in the pool.
This is, yeah. You kind of passed over the fact that they did shoot it.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't seem to do much.
It knocked it down for a second. It's not invulnerable, even if it may be immortal.
Yeah, it'll get slightly slowed down, and they're also like shooting at Greg.
Stop shooting at me! Yeah,
but this, she's able to escape. She is able to get out like the front of the boathouse, mm-hmm. And flee. And then as she's fleeing, her friends are coming up. The form of it changes again. It's now Annie from the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And she panics and drives away and is looking back after it. Doesn't see somebody pull out. Gets into an accident and she's in the hospital. So, you know, exactly where you want to be when there's a something coming at you that will never stop. You know, famously easy to leave hospitals. This is this like setup that she passes it on to Greg, who's just like, well, don't believe what's happening to you, but.
I'll take one for the team. Yeah.
It's like filmed like a 90s REM video. Where you're like, everybody hurts going around the hospital, all these like conversations. And then it gets to their room as he's slipped in and, you know, and slipped in.
He did slip in.
So she has passed it on to him. And then there's this like, we haven't really talked too much about the music yet.
So good.
This score definitely wants to place it as like a Carpenter 80s movie. Mm-hmm. It's by the band Disaster Piece, or I guess I shouldn't say band, like the person Disaster Piece.
They do a lot of video game soundtracks.
Yeah, and that's where David Robert Mitchell found them. He played Fez, and they did the soundtrack for that, which is a very clever and kind of infuriatingly clever game, where it's like what if Myst from the 90s made you scan a URL to solve a puzzle, and you're just like, damn it. But yeah, we get this kind of like breakdown piece that's playing like real treacly, because we know he's got it, and it's just showing him living his best life. He's hanging out.
It doesn't seem like it's in very much of a hurry to get to him.
this montage of just him like hanging out and having a good time is like just like he might as well be like Archie from the Archie comics. Just like everything's going great for me, guys.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you think this is intentional, or like, I mean, is it another way of saying like women are more vulnerable, or like guys have it easier, or is it just like a taste thing for the monster? Like he's like, ugh, another dude. Fuck, I'll get there eventually.
I mean, I think it's again kind of that dream logic, and we don't know how long they were at that beach. They could have been there for like the weekend and just underestimated how fast somebody could walk.
We do know it was at least 3 days from the time he was infected to the time he actually gets got.
Yeah. Because he checks in on Jay as well, and she's, you know, she's taking precautions and locking herself up and not, you know, taking visitors, and he's, again, out there living his life. And
he has not seen it to this point.
Yeah. Before she sees him across the street go up to his own house and, you know, just throw a stone through the window and climb in his own window.
I kind of think flops in the window.
I kind of think this is a little bit of a homage to Nightmare on Elm Street here, because she's trying to like call him and warn him of the house across the street.
I was thinking that too. Yeah, how she's like watching from the window. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she runs over to help out. And we see Greg's mom in her best Freudian slip knocking on the door. Those are the groans I go for.
They give me life.
knocking on Greg's door, and she's shouting, Greg, like, don't answer the door. And he's just like, Mom! Opens the door, gets assaulted by his half-naked mother. Like, a lot of electricity shooting out of the room. That's kind of what seems to be the method of just wet electricity. And humping a toaster seems to be kind of like what it does.
That's what I'd imagine sex with my mom's like.
Oh, my God.
Jed, you have the ability to edit this show. You know that, right?
Like, no, I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave that in. I said what I said. Does it sound like something I want to do? Given that description?
But they flee again. And this time it's just Jay flees, and she it's a little nebulous. We know the intention here, but we don't really know the outcome, where she flees to the beach again and sees three men on a boat and starts stripping down and swimming out to them.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, right?
Yeah, but it's also like the entity comes right back after her, like almost immediately in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Right, because when she comes back, it seemed like I believe the intent is for you to think that she did. But as soon as she comes back, it very much seems like she didn't.
Yeah, I think it's kind of intentionally like nebulous. And I think if those three guys got just with like the speed at which the entity comes back, that this like girl that they had like a foursome with like what? Leaves, and all of a sudden they look over and they're like, another girl?
Right. Like, if they're all
what a day.
Oh, sure. Then maybe that is what is supposed to have happened, is like that they all just got right away.
Yeah.
Did she give it to all three of them? Is that how that works?
Unclear.
Okay.
I believe there are several videos on the internet that might address this very scenario. But yeah, the she comes back, and again, like our valiant white knight Paul is just, by the way, I will also volunteer my services.
He's like, you know, I too have a penis.
if you would allow me.
I volunteer as tribute. But it's actually his suggestion turns out to be very sweet and very smart. He doesn't want to help in the way we think he wants to help, right?
He would have.
Well, yeah, 100%. That's not what he's proposing, though.
But he has a plan. He does have a plan. And the plan, again, not the best, but also intentionally not the best plan, because it's the plan that young dummies come up with, is that they're going to go to like a swimming pool they used to go to. They have this, like, Yara gives this big speech about how dangerous Detroit is and how her parents didn't want her to go, like, past a certain point. And
can't go past 8 Mile.
Past 8 Mile.
Yeah, because that's Mom Spaghetti territory.
Yeah. Fucking Eminem. All over the place down there.
She says, you know, for anyone who isn't familiar with Detroit or 8 Mile, like, she says it's, quote, like, where the suburbs end and the city begins.
Yeah.
You know. If it's not already abundantly clear by the visuals that we're seeing.
Yeah, because they are driving like through increasingly like blown out and abandoned areas. But it's also just sort of interesting that they they go back to the water. again, there's just like so much of that in this movie, but like there's also like that's where the first kiss happened, and then like
Kelly chimes around in. Water a lot in this movie.
Well, and the parallel here I thought that was striking was that, you know, again back to the first one of the first scenes where Jay is in the world's smallest above ground pool. This is the biggest goddamn pool I've ever seen in my life, like that they're in this scene. So
it's well maintained in an area that you wouldn't think could support a pool like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's it seems to be like a place they have to like break chains off of doors to get into, but there's like some Phantom of the Opera type figure who's like in there chlorinating the pool every night and keeping this,
right.
this grand thing up and running. We did pass over a little bit, like one of the more like signature visual moments of this movie, that when they pull away to enact this plan, they see that the entity is at her house and it's just a naked man on top of her house. Which
on the roof. Really,
that seems out of character for it. Titular it.
Why?
Well, King Kong's got nothing on him.
Well, I mean, every other time we see him, he's just walking directly towards somebody. Why is he stalking on someone's house? How did he even get up there?
Maybe that's the point. Like, they, you know, you can't predict its movements.
Yeah, I think earlier, like, Hugh does say, like, it is smart. So they've got, like, the door barred and it has no way in. Like, it's kind of just waiting for her move. Like, it's just up there. Like.
All right. I'll buy it.
Yeah. But this this plan they have is not just to go to the pool for a good time. They are going to surround the pool with plugged in electronics connected to, you know, power strips, have Jay in the pool so that when the entity shows up, she can like flee in any direction and point out where it is. And then once the entity gets into the pool, they're going to throw the electric devices into the pool and electrocute it.
And can I just say too, like, I love how Scooby-Doo this whole plan feels, you know? And honestly, like, Yara from the beginning has been giving me serious, like, Velma vibes. I just, I don't know. But it didn't really quite click to me until this scene where I was like, oh my god, it's like the Scooby-Doo game.
They really needed a scene of them in a hallway going in and out of different doors.
She drops her clamshell reader and gets on the ground and starts feeling around for it.
My C reader. I can't read Dostoevsky without my C reader.
So it shows up and Jay says that she sees the entity, and they say, what does it look like? And she says, I do not want to say. And I'm sure y'all picked up on it later on. I don't know if you picked up on it from the beginning. You do see like some pictures of the deceased father.
I didn't put it together until afterwards because they hone in on that picture pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, it's not stupid. It's just, it's looking at what they've got set up, and instead of getting into the pool, just starts picking up all the shit they have up there and throwing it at Jay.
This is funny.
Yeah, to which they say, like, well, it didn't work. And they're like, well, yeah, thank God.
Right. And then Kelly throws a sheet over it.
That comes a little bit later. There is, like, some struggle here, because Paul
sees...
Yeah,
one important bit before that.
Yeah. Paul's got the revolver, and he runs over and just sees, like, a piece of electronics being listed up, but he doesn't know, like, where it is in relation to that, and just fires blindly and clips Yara in the leg.
They need to teach some trigger discipline. That's all I'm saying.
But yeah, Kelly does throw this. So we do see that it, we already knew that it has, like, actual physical shape, but they get visibility on it, and then they're able to pop one in its head. It falls in the water, but it's not done. It keeps chasing after Jay underwater and takes a few more shots before we get, like, our setup for our final jump scare. I feel like this is, like, in a different movie would have been where, like, the hand comes up and grabs her.
Yeah.
But Jay peers back into the pool and just sees the red mist but of blood, but it's all just coming down towards her. So we get into the end game of this movie. I'm curious how this all, like, I think most people pick up on, like, the very end that they're still being, like, pursued by something, but finally our dream couple, Jay and Paul, get together. Happy ending, wedding bells in the future.
About that.
before like the real sketchy moment where like their new plan is Paul cruises around looking as hard as he can and finds some sex workers just to like, mm-hmm. you know, pass this along to. Yeah, that's a thing that happens in this movie.
mm-hmm.
It definitely sucks, but I can see why you would why your thought process would go there.
Oh, I know. When I saw this for the first time with my friends, one of them was just like, you know what? This isn't scary at all. All you have to do is find your sluttiest friend and then just pass it on. And
then just be good with murdering them. Just be real cool with signing their death warrant.
Just the rest of your day.
Well, no, I mean, ideally, they'd still be having a lot of sex. So even if it killed the person that they had sex with, they'd still be doing stuff.
Just that, you know, your John, your regular John. Yeah. Well, they died. Oh, that's like the fifth one. Interesting. Weird. Yeah. So like the movie ends just basically with a the end ... question mark where they're walking down the street holding hands and they're
no, Josh, you skipped over.
Oh, what I skip here?
Yara,
oh yes, we do hospital. Have our final idiot quote. So this bit, it's not a book I've read, but the one thing I do know about Dostoevsky is that he was a member of a political movement a literary political movement that wrote like politically unpopular stuff, and he was sentenced to death. And basically, like, at the absolute last possible moment before he was going to be, like, executed via guillotine, the execution was called off. And he was pardoned and free to go. So this bit of the idiot where a character is about to be executed via guillotine. And the thing about the guillotine is that it was presented as being, like, a humane execution method. Because it's not torture. You're just, like...
Yeah.
You're done.
Snap.
But this bit that she's reading is that the real torture of this moment of the guillotine is that you know with absolute certainty that there's going to be a moment where you are no longer a person, where you are cognizant and aware, and then your life is ended, and you are flooded with regret. You're flooded with the what-as, could-as, should-as, and like tortured within that moment. It's not a painless death, because awareness of your death is enough to cause tremendous pain and suffering.
Right. And it's also just about, again, the eternal footman. It's just about death in general. And she says like the worst thing that is that it is certain. So,
yeah. You know,
about any death in any manner.
And it's something that you are, as a human being, you're cognizant, you're aware of it, and it's to various degrees, always, it's always there. And I think that's what this monster is at the end, is it's like, it's always coming for you. Like, it's moving real slowly, but it might be closer than you think it is.
That, Jed, is why this is a horror movie.
Oh my god.
That's why like existentialist texts are in fact horror novels.
I can see it. Like the argument there is fine. I was honestly halfway being serious when I presented that at the top of the show anyway.
Just trying to get your segments in. I get it.
Yeah. Like, I got bits.
So I guess we are ready to, unless there's other stuff y'all wanted to talk about in this movie, to head up onto the sales floor.
No, let's go.
Executive decision from Jen there. Great. That's
Yeah.
That's what we expect from the third leg of this podcast.
So I know you've seen this before and you had a lot of thoughts about it. Where do you rank this one, Jen, before we move on to the official tallied count?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Where do I rank it? Like in my personal list or
of all?
Yeah, I mean, I know you've yeah. What number sequence do you put it in against everything? Every experience you've ever had.
Well, no. I'm sorry. I wasn't.
I'm just curious if there's like if this is one that on this viewing has resonated differently, or kind of where you hold this and kind of the pantheon.
I will say, like, the first time I saw this, I was underwhelmed, and I think it was just because it was being so hyped up at the time. Like you said, like, everyone was saying it was the first, like, elevated horror film that had come along in years, and I just kind of, I don't know, maybe that all was stacked against it, and it really affected my viewing experience. But I have since then seen it. I think this viewing was my fourth time.
Okay.
I like it so much more now. Like, I just, yeah, being removed from the hype and like really having time to think over all of the themes and just analyze the cinematography and everything. Like, it's a perfect movie. It really is. It is.
That is a bold claim.
Yeah.
Arjet, are you joining the perfect club? Are you
I don't think I can quite go perfect on this one.
I think that, like, the pitch I would make to you, Jen kind of covered a lot of it, but I think
I don't know
this
if you can make a better pitch than it's a perfect movie.
It's a perfect movie. Done.
What else can you say?
But I also think it's one that was like maybe a bit of a sea change. I was kind of looking at release dates for other stuff, and I feel like the only other movie that was sort of like discussed in this way that I saw kind of come out like in a similar time frame was, I think, Under the Skin came out right before this.
Okay.
Well, like, a lot of the A24 stuff hadn't really hit yet. And I think this movie like really kind of pushes that along, and it's kind of that marriage of like, I loves me, you know, we watched Pumpkinhead last time, so I do loves me like a VHS cult hit, a popcorn favorite, but I think this kind of operates on a different level, and I think it really kind of succeeds pretty well on that level. And even if like David Robert Mitchell has like been a little cagey about wanting to say exactly what it means, because you know he thinks art should be interpreted by individuals and your meaning is just as valid as his, blah, 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 the author. But I think there's like enough here where it's like not polemic about it, and it also like really kind of gives you like those images that like stick with you, that man too big, can't fit through door, man too big. Yeah, I'm curious where this one lands for you.
All right, I will say right up front, I'm not buying this one.
Oh.
But I will say that I reserve the right to change my mind on this depending on how I feel after having sat on it for a while. Because I just watched it this afternoon, and I think I said this last episode when we were talking about watching it for this episode, that this is something that I had sat down to watch before, because Jen said, I had heard a lot of good things about it. And for whatever reason, I got to the point where, I'm trying to think of where I left off. I got about halfway through it. I don't remember exactly where I stopped watching. I got about halfway through it and then had to go do some other things. I didn't realize what time it was or whatever. I didn't stop watching because I wasn't having fun with it. I just stopped watching because I had to go. But I never came back to it for whatever reason. It didn't grab me enough to pull me back into it. And that's sort of where this viewing has left me. Like Jen said, she was underwhelmed the first time she saw it. I kind of feel the same way. But a lot of times when we watch movies on this show, even ones that I like, I'll find myself thinking about them, you know, as we go through days and weeks afterwards. And a lot of times my opinion will solidify. I don't know that I've really had one completely flip on me. But
Ginger Snaps, baby. Ginger Snaps was our only flip.
I was close on that one at record. So, I mean, yes, that did happen. I said no, and then I backed off it on the next episode. But I don't know. You guys pointed out a lot of stuff that on a surface level viewing, maybe I didn't pick up on. And maybe, you know, having a day or two to think about it, my opinion would change. Because I didn't find this movie to be offensively bad or anything like that. It didn't do a lot for me.
Whatever.
Nope. Very fair. Mm-hmm. Like when I saw it the first time, I was underwhelmed. I couldn't really understand why everybody was freaking out so much about it. But I hope that it does kind of sit with you, like when you sit with it.
There's definitely pieces that I can see as something that would stick with me for a while, like some mm-hmm. some images or some, you know, some particular scenes or whatever the case may be. But just having watched it this afternoon, I'm just left feeling a little lukewarm on it.
All right. I will take my lump on that one, but also, like, I'm gonna set that in the penalty box and see if it gets to come out for sanctioned play next time.
Yes, please.
we can revisit, see if anything changed.
All right. Well, I've got this Crispin Glover Award for acting excellence here that I need to hand out, and I really want to, like,
titular it. That's what's so great about it is one person throughout the whole thing, versatile.
So
you're already flipping, I can tell.
Micah Monroe is absolutely great in this movie. I think she sells it, but it's a lot of, like, kind of intentionally understated performances in this movie. Like, I think that's part of, like, the dreamlike logic of it, is it's people getting really scared and panicking, but it's also, like, those moments, like we were saying, where, like, she's maybe dissociating a bit and processing, and, like, and a lot of the characters kind of have that, and it's all kind of at a subdued level. I think she really sells that really well. But I'm handing this to Mike Lanier, the one of the tallest twins in the world. Too big. He is too big. He will take this award out of my hand if I try to hand it to somebody else, and I don't want to.
We'll never get it back, because he'll just hold it up and you'll just be flailing your arms and hopping and looking real dumb.
But yeah, that's where this award's settling. So let's talk a little bit about next time. I got a little a multiple choice here for our guest, Jen. Pick one out for us.
I'm buzzing in.
You're buzzing in.
I'm buzzing in. Next time we're doing something different. I'm picking the movie.
Oh, what? Oh, okay. All right.
You can get the one after that, but I'm getting the next one.
Which Friday the 13th are we doing, Jed?
All of them. We're going to do the one I liked and see if it's still I like it. I want to knock that average down.
Do you want to, since we introduced the game, let's go ahead and do that.
What we're doing next. I'm just saying that.
We'll do next after next. Got it.
Yeah.
It'll be our Christmas movie then. Okay. Well, it's a little bit a fairly untraditional Christmas, but sure. So I thought about It Follows, and, you know, the most obvious place to go would be to watch It after It Follows, right?
Yeah.
But I also looked at just those letters, that IT. So should we do, like, a technical movie? Should we do no. A movie
starring T.I.?
It is also, you know, short for Italy. So we have not gone back to Italy for a while. I've got four Italian films here, and I'm going to let you choose which one we do after we do Jed's movie. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Just a straight up choice here. We could do Deep Red, which we haven't. We've only done Suspiria from Argento.
Mm-hmm.
We could do a Bay of Blood, which you took a class on, right?
Yes.
We could also do a movie that we saw together in the theater, Demons. We could do Demons for that one. And then our final choice here, I know Jed just loves Italian movies that are ripoffs of other popular American movies.
Love it.
The Rosemary's Baby knockoff made by one of the great masters, I think, of Italian horror. He doesn't get quite enough credit. Sergio Martino. All the Colors of the Dark. Do that one. A psychedelic Rosemary's Baby ripoff. So what are we going with for that, for our Christmas movie, Jen?
Oh boy, can you read them one more time, please?
We got Deep Red,
mm-hmm.
Bay of Blood, Demons, and All the Colors of the Dark.
Oh man, well I'm so torn because I've only seen two of them.
Okay.
I feel like, oh man, this is hard. I'm just going to go with Bay of Blood.
Bay of Blood. Jed did not like our last Mario Bava movie. So heads up.
Can I take it back?
No, we're locked in.
All decisions are final.
Oh, no.
No refunds. Yeah, so awesome. That will be our Christmas movie. I think that's a good Christmas movie.
I'm looking forward for a Bava bounce back.
So Jed, what are we actually doing next time?
Next time, yeah, I didn't prepare a game or anything. I just watched a movie kind of on a whim and said, yeah, we can talk about this on the show. You know, right. Whatever. It's a more recent film. Okay. I think I would like to discuss Barbarian.
Oh my God.
All right. Jen is a fan, I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I look forward to doing that. We'll do we'll talk about how to best weaponize actors with Barbarian.
So I take it you've seen it then.
Oh, I have, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. I was hoping I'd pull something out that you hadn't quite watched yet because it's so new, but I should have known.
I think even if I hadn't seen it, just the grab me by the lapels and shake me endorsement of that film that Jen gave me from seeing it first.
I've seen it twice now.
It's fair. It definitely took me by surprise a little bit.
All right. Awesome. Before we move on to business, is there anything you all wanted to recommend, shout out?
No.
I've been loving the new season of White Lotus. Jennifer Coolidge, as always, is just a national treasure. So highly recommend that. Yeah. And I also just saw The Menu, which was, I would highly recommend. The new Ralph Fiennes, Anya Taylor-Joy, Nicholas Hoult.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I did think of something.
I'd
like to recommend Dead Grandparents.
Oh, yeah. Give a shout out to Mama Hop and Peepop.
Yeah, you know.
All right, well, let's just talk through the business stuff here. Please reach out to us. We can be found on Facebook at the Scream Selling Group. Selling the Scream Group. Our email address is sellingthescream@gmail.com. If you wish to search for us in the smoldering ashes of Twitter, we are at Screams Selling.
I think we're going to have to find a new place to go.
We're like maybe WhatsApp or Discord or
LinkedIn or
send toots on Mastodon.
Yeah, I don't know. Smoke signals.
Yeah, but please reach out to us. If you could, if we've made a drive any better, a work day, leave us a review on the podcatcher of your choice. iTunes does drive the most traffic. Spotify, it's also pretty high up there, too. It does say here, I keep getting these updates, it does say that if you leave a bad review, the bad reviews are cursed. But they do come with free frozen yogurt. So
that's good.
I'm not going to do the whole bit.
All right.
They didn't write that out. They only wrote that it comes with free frozen yogurt. So.
Do you think they even knew it was a bit?
Anyway, yeah, thank you so much for joining us again, Jen.
Yeah, always a pleasure. I really enjoy having you on the show. I think you bring a lot of energy, good energy, that maybe we're missing sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, I am always happy to join, so thank you.
Yeah, but until then, until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, thank you.